setting out to prepare what I wanted to say this morning, I was very much aware there could probably be no greater case of preaching to the choir than for a Unitarian Universalist minister to be defending the theory or principle of human evolution before a UU congregation. I thought of the often told story, which may or may not be true, of President Calvin Coolidge and his being a man of few words. Story goes, he came home from church one Sunday and his wife asked him what the minister's sermon was about. Coolidge replied, "Sin." "Well, Calvin," his wife persisted, "what did the preacher have to say about it?" Coolidge answered, "He was against it." I can see a similar kind of exchange taking place with respect to this sermon. So what'd Steve say about evolution? He liked it. Indeed, if I were to offer a point-by-point defense of the theory of evolution, I'm sure I'd soon be looking at a bunch of glazed-over eyes. Instead, then, I think we might do well to consider where the continual opposition to and fear of this quite self-evident principle keeps coming from. My take, to get it at the outset, is the opposition to the teaching of evolution or the counter-move to offer the concept of intelligent design doesn't really come from a blanket anti-science stance so much as it comes from the fear of losing a story, the fear of the loss of a uniquely human identity. So you can put that one on the shelf for now. I'm going to come back to it later. The evolution debate itself has been an ongoing narrative almost as long as the theory itself has been in existence. An early chapter in that narrative, which many of us are familiar with, will be Dayton, Tennessee in the summer of 1925, the date and place of the Scopes trial, where a 24-year-old biology teacher named John Scopes was indicted for teaching Darwin's theory of evolution in the Dayton public schools. The prosecution team brought in William Jennings Bryan to lead the charge. Bryan had been recommended and brought to Dayton by way of an organization called the World Christian Fundamentalist Association. And for Mr. Scopes, it was Clarence Darrow for the defense. The trial and the subsequent movie about it, Inherit the Wind, pointed to a divide that did and still does run through American Protestantism, as well as across the greater religious landscape. It's the divide between moderate to liberal religious folks on the one side, for whom things like evolution, geologic ages, and the like pose no threat to their faith, and the conservative to fundamentalist folk for whom such things do. In this configuration, Mr. Darrow is the hero for standing up for science and intellectual freedom in the face of religious know-nothingism as embodied by Mr. Bryan. But Mr. Bryan is really a very complex figure. And I think that characterization of him, both in the movie and in the stories that are told about this, is something of a bad rap. So a starting point in gaining some greater understanding of this ongoing evolution debate, then, will be to take a closer look at him. William Jennings Bryan was the Democratic Party's nominee, three times no less, for President of the United States. He ran and lost each time on populist and progressive platforms that included his championing the rights of working class men and women, labor reform, and a woman's right to vote. He was, that is to say, on many of the same sides of many social issues in his day as were our Unitarian and our Universalist forebears. He was Secretary of State under President Woodrow Wilson, and he resigned that position when he could not, in good faith and conscience, support the President's decision to take this country into World War I. Whatever your opinion on that matter may be, I think you have to give Bryan points for personal integrity and courage. Bryan was also a Christian fundamentalist. He truly believed that the teaching of evolution was an atheistic assault upon American school children. But he had two other reasons for his opposition. He was concerned and disturbed about what would happen if Darwin's principle of the survival of the fittest came to be applied to social policy. If the true story of life on this planet is that of the stronger and more versatile elements of a species surviving at the expense of the weaker elements of that species, and if this is the right and true nature of things on this planet, then why even bother with things like morality and ethics and caring for those whom Jesus called the least of these? Did the least of these even deserve to live under the principles of evolution? This was a very real and a very troubling question for Mr. Bryan. This fear, as real as it was for him, has proven to be largely unfounded. While in the social and political arenas, we still debate the extent to which government programs and policies should be geared to assist those in need. I think it's pretty safe to say that our social policy, by and large, a few exceptions here and there, but by and large, it is not driven by a rigid kind of social Darwinism, even though the theory of evolution itself has come to be widely accepted. But there was a third fear that William Jennings Bryan had of evolution, which his spiritual descendants still hold on to today. And that is the fear of meaninglessness. If the story of life on Earth is no more than that of simpler life forms evolving into more complex life forms, with human beings coming out of that process, then our intrinsic worth as human beings is really no more than that of a mosquito that we reflexively swat out of existence whenever one annoys us. If we are not God's crowning act of creation, as the book of Genesis teaches, then our life has no inherent meaning. Absent a creator God, we are adrift in a sea of meaninglessness. So felt William Jennings Bryan, so feel apparently his religious successors. And this is what I see as being the issue behind the issue in this seemingly endless debate over evolution and creationism, with such ideas as intelligent design or scientific creationism being the latest variations on that debate theme. The issue behind the issue is how do we find meaning in our lives? How do we best live with one another? And more to the point, what kind of stories do we tell to help us answer these questions? So having endless debates over who has the better science or who can muster the better arguments for their respective positions doesn't really get at the core of this thing. That's like a couple constantly arguing over who is doing the better job of keeping the house cleaned up, when what they're really arguing about runs deeper than that. Any family therapist will tell you that the first act in working with a situation like that is to locate the real issue behind the presenting issue and then go from there. So what if we think of this creation evolution issue as the presenting one, with the bigger issue being that of story? Yeah, I said story. Story in this case with a capital S. I offer this with the idea, with the truth actually, that we human beings do not live by scientific principles and by scientific theories alone. We cannot, to be sure, live without them in this day and age if we're going to continue to survive and thrive and grow. But ultimately, we live by our stories. I know I've spoken of this in a couple of my more recent sermons, so I'm briefly revisiting the point here. It is the stories we tell that really guide us in our search for a better understanding of who we are and why we're here and what we mean to one another. We all tell our family stories because being a Smith or a Jones or an Eddington or whatever name it is you bear out there means something to the persons who bear those names because of all the family narratives that are behind them. And the meanings that come out of those narratives go far beyond just a process of successive procreations. What gives the citizens of any country or nation or culture their identity is the story, or the stories that are told about that country or that nation or that culture, which is more than just a recounting of a succession of historical events. Whether we have any kind of specifically religious beliefs or not, we human beings, each and all of us, have an inborn need to locate ourselves in some greater narrative that tells us something about who we are and about the world and the universe in which we live. And beyond those stories or narratives of family or nation or culture, most human beings also seek after what could be called a greater ultimate narrative, if you will. An ultimate narrative that gives us our identity as human beings on this planet and as creatures in a vast and mysterious universe. And this is the story that religion or religions have traditionally provided. And so the issue behind the issue for the creationists is this fear of the loss of an ultimate story, with all that such a loss could seemingly portend. And since we now unavoidably live in the scientific era, then the creationists are going to fight for their story on the scientific front with such constructs as scientific creationism or intelligent design. And I'm not going to jump into that debate right now, or I'm not going to jump into it this morning, actually, other than to say that the idea of some kind of a creative intelligence at work behind the origins and behind the workings of the universe, I can see where that would well be a topic of interest for a class in, say, philosophy or anthropology, and I would love to have that conversation in that kind of a context, but I can't see it being used. Creative intelligence, intelligent design, scientific creationism, I cannot see any of those things worthy as a discussion on a philosophical level as they might be, as being put forth as a substitute for the theory of evolution. But rather than pursue that point any further, I want to stay with this idea of an ultimate story. And in so doing, I'm just going to briefly introduce to you a book by Michael Dowd, came out about a year and a half ago. It's called, maybe 2 years ago now, it's called Thank God for Evolution. Now, Mr. Dowd, make that Reverend Dowd, he's a rather interesting guy. He was very much, and probably in some places still is, he's very much on the Unitarian Universalist and the liberal Christian circuit right when his book first came out a couple of years ago. He appeared at several of our district conferences around our Unitarian Universalist Association. I got John, was he at one of our district conferences? Yeah, he appeared at a...
2 years ago.
2 years ago at the at our, what was then the New Hampshire-Vermont district conference. Well, Reverend Dowd was originally a conservative evangelist. He was opposed, as he writes in the very first chapter of the book, to this theory of evolution and its being taught. But apparently, the more he studied the theory, the more he became convinced of its validity. So he did a 180 on the whole thing, and he has now become an evangelist for evolution, while still retaining a lot of the religious language that he used in his evangelical days to help make his case. He's firmly gotten himself in the liberal Christian camp now. His idea of God is very similar to the idea put forth by your naturalistic theology, naturalistic theologians, which sees God not as a supreme being, but God as simply the natural unfolding process of life itself within the natural world, very close to the spirit of life, which we sing about here every Sunday. And Dowd also makes the point, as I have, about how we human beings find meaning and direction in our lives by seeing our lives, again, as part of a larger story or a narrative. So what Dowd does in his book is treat evolution as a sacred story in and of itself. Well, the book runs on for nearly 400 pages, and I'm only going to cite one passage that I think largely captures the gist of his position. It goes like this. Humanity is the fruit of 14 billion years of unbroken evolution. When the Bible speaks of God forming us from the dust of the earth, it is absolutely true. We did not come into this world, we grew out of it, just like an apple grows from an apple tree. We are the universe becoming conscious of itself. We are stardust that has begun to contemplate the stars. Just hang with those last two lines. We are the universe becoming conscious of itself. We are stardust that has begun to contemplate the stars. For I think these two lines actually explain why practically every religion that exists or ever has existed on Earth has a creation story. If we accept the Big Bang, which I do, which holds that the entire universe burst forth and continues to expand from a single entity, that means that we, our bodies, our brains, are one part of just that bigger stuff of the whole universe itself. We human beings just happen to be a particular piece of that stuff that has become aware of both ourselves and the universe in which we live. This is what Dowd means when he says, we, meaning we human beings, we are the universe become conscious of itself. We are stardust that has begun to contemplate the stars. We human beings are a piece of the universe that has evolved to the point where we want and need to know who we are and where we've come from. And in a pre-scientific age, we told stories to get at those ultimate questions. Now we engage in scientific exploration. And Dowd's point, which I fully accept, is that for all of our scientific explorations, we still haven't lost our need for story, our need to find some deeper meaning to it all. And this is why I think that religion in one form or another is always going to be around, is always going to be with us. Using doubt as a jumping off point then, I'll offer the story that I tell myself and that tells me, tells us in turn, hopefully something about our highest identity. It begins, as already noted, with what is colloquially called the Big Bang, and focuses in on how at least one planet, there could be others out there somewhere, but we know of at least one planet in this vast universe that has evolved life forms to the point where they even name themselves and found the need to tell stories about how they got here. So, to play off a line by Humphrey Bogart, Casablanca, of all the planets and all the galaxies and all the universe, we had to show up here. Here, on a celestial body that has brought forth a creature through a process of millions of years of evolution, who can step outside of itself and ask questions of itself. This creature has even gotten so far evolved it's come up with a way of getting itself off its home base and far enough out in space to take a picture of its own planet and take a look at itself from that point of view. The creature came to see itself then as the result of a creative process. And indeed, that is correct. This same creature is now having an argument with itself about whether or not there's a willful creator behind that process. But we're going to slip by that one and continue the story I just begun. Once this creature got to the point where it could stand outside itself and look at itself and ask questions of itself, it began to create works of art and music and literature, with some of those works being better than others. This creature used its powers of thought and imagination to build up tribes, and then societies, and civilizations. And it evolved, this is what happens when you jump a page when you're not done with it, right? This creature used its powers of thought and imagination to build up tribes, civilizations, and then societies. It used these same powers of thought to at least begin to understand the workings of the world and the universe in which it was located. And then early on in its collective life, this creature, who came to call itself human, also discovered that it was capable of doing some pretty horrible things, some pretty destructive things to itself, to other creatures, to the planet itself. And it discovered it could also do some great, wonderful, and life-enhancing things as well. And the human creature wondered about all this. And it created certain kinds of understandings and agreements among its members that would at least hopefully try to protect itself from its self-destructive side and enhance its life-affirming side. And these agreements came to be codes of law and morality and ethics and justice. And sometimes those agreements were kept, sometimes they're broken. And breaking those agreements has often cost this human creature dearly, sometimes too often, in fact. That cost has run up to the point that's included horrible wars and genocides. But so far anyway, this human creature has managed to survive its own follies and its broken promises to itself and still survive and grow and advance in even greater knowledge and creativity. And there's one more thing, one more piece to this creaturely creation story. As the creature that called itself human learned more about its own story, we came to recognize a relationship. It's a relationship. You heard about it in the Circle of Life song. It's a relationship that holds that all the various parts of life on this planet are connected to one another, that each depends upon the other for its life and livelihood. We're still seeking to understand the full meaning of this relationship. We're still trying to learn how we can best treat one another as related members of what we have now come to call the human family, and how we best treat and most meaningfully participate in the whole chain of life, in the whole circle of life that our planet contains. This is the spiritual challenge that we who have evolved to the point of calling ourselves human now have to deal with. How do we connect with? How do we experience? How do we most meaningfully and responsibly live within this circle of life that has now brought us to where we are. Well, that's the story that at least gives the human life I'm trying to live its meaning. Hopefully, it does the same for you. It is a story that does not neatly provide answers in some neatly packaged way. It does not explain in some neatly packaged way again some of the terrible personal tragedies that befall us, nor does it explain some of the personal demons that many of us have to do battle with. It just means we have to find ways, if we are related, of standing with one another in love and compassion when such tragedies or such demons overtake us at times. But it's a story that hopefully points us in a good and positive direction in seeking at least partial answers to ultimate questions, knowing that our knowledge is incomplete and will still be incomplete for each one of us when the lives that we have been given to live are no longer ours on this earth. Much of that story will always remain in the realm of mystery and wonder. Whether or not there is some great willful purpose with a capital P behind this story, that's part of the mystery of it. We cannot know for sure. For myself, I'll just live with the story and continue to see whatever mysteries may still be revealed in the time that I have to become aware of them. I'm going to close with this. The story I have told, and which I'm sure most of you could tell your own variation on, is one that places us human beings within a larger and ever ongoing chain or circle of life, rather than seeing us as the final crowning and end result of a timeline, like the pyramid that Loretta spoke to. Our image is that of the circle instead of the pyramid. And it is within this chain or circle that we affirm our worth and dignity and extend that worth and dignity to our fellow human beings. It is within this chain of life that we search for ways to show compassion for all creatures with whom we share a relationship. It is within this chain that we keep searching for ever deeper ways of knowing what our interdependence means and who and what it calls us to be. And finally, while this story is told entirely within the confines and workings of the natural world and universe, which I believe is the only reality we have, I still find a certain miraculous quality about it. It is the miracle of existence, the miracle of our ability to know and experience existence. It is the miracle of which the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh writes in this passage with which I will close. I like to walk along country paths, rice plants and wild grasses on both sides, putting each foot down on the earth in mindfulness, knowing that I walk on a wondrous earth. In such moments, existence is a miraculous and mysterious reality. People usually consider walking on water or in thin air a miracle. But I think the miracle is not to walk on either water or thin air, but to walk on earth. Every day, we are engaged in a miracle we don't recognize. A blue sky, white clouds, green leaves, the black, curious eyes of a child, our own two eyes, all is miracle. With that thought, let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 175. We celebrate the web of life.